Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Lob Podcast from These Football Times. My name is Gary Thacker, and we're back with Series 2 of Mount Rushmore. It's a series where we ask invited guests to select the four players, one goalkeeper, one defender, one midfielder, and one forward, who they believe deserve to be immortalised on their club's own Mount Rushmore monument. It's not necessarily about the best players, the longest serving, or top goal scorers. It's for each guest to choose the players that they feel are the most deserving. Before we introduce this week's guest and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and his club, I introduce my co-host, only one today, and I'll explain why shortly, and that's Aidan Williamson. How you doing, Aidan?
Evening there, Gary. Yes, looking forward to another fine episode here. We're delving into a club that, you know, love them or loathe them, and people, it's very Marmite, I think. For a lot of people, this club, it's a club that leaves you spoiled for choice, doesn't it, in terms of great players to pick. So, and I do mean truly great in this case for multiple eras as well. And it fits in with something we've mentioned on other episodes too, that I think the age of the guest plays a little bit into the some of the picks. But, you know, I think this being a club with a glorious recent past as well as a glorious past, I think it's fully justified in what way any choices may go tonight.
Dead right, brother, yeah. And to talk about having plenty of choices, you say, for players, that'd be fun. Yeah, so our other co-host, Steve, he's not with us today. He's on the injury list, but given the club we're going to be talking about, I and myself were discussing whether the possibility it was a classic Ryan Giggs thigh strain when Wales have got a friendly. And I wasn't too keen on discussing and lauding the players of the club we're going to be talking about. I'm only kidding, Steve, you feel better soon, mate. So, on to our guest, and today we're welcoming one of our own, one of TFT's very own. It's Mr. Josh Butler. How are you doing, Josh?
Oh, very well, thank you, and thank you for having me on.
Delighted, mate. So tell us a little bit about yourself and about the team and why you support the team. And given the sort of history the club's got that Aidan mentioned to, have you sort of applied any parameters? Did you sort of say only players that you've seen, only players in the last X number of years or whatever, because there's such a rich history at this club?
Yeah, so it's a bit like, I grew up in the 90s because I was born in 1990. So a lot of people just assume that I picked Man United because they were best. But I didn't get a choice. My dad was a Man United fan. Ergo, I had to be a Manchester United fan. So it was quite a fortunate era to grow up in, I suppose. Like, my best mate's a Burnley fan. So his dad was a Burnley fan. He became a Burnley fan. So he wasn't quite bequeathed with the riches that I enjoyed as a kid. But no, I've been a United fan all my life. Been to Old Trafford numerous times. First game I ever saw was, I think it was the League Cup against Bury, and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer scored the first goal I ever saw at Old Trafford. And when it came to picking my own team, I chatted to my dad, and I decided that I was going to employ the rule of only picking players that I had witnessed during my lifetime. Because my dad's team of four players only had one in common with mine. But because I hadn't seen most of them, I didn't think it was fair for me to pick them. But I'll definitely talk about who they are when it comes to each one, because I think a lot of older Man United fans would pick my dad's team over mine.
I mean, this is the beauty of this series. And, you know, the ultimate arbiter is your choice. And, you know, you obviously pick the players you want, but as I say, the joy of this sort of series is we can look at who came close and, you know, get the ball out and have a kick around and discuss the pros and cons of other players. So, now, as mentioned, we're going to go with a goalkeeper, defender, midfielder, and forward. And then I'm going to ask you at the end of the episode to pick your Mr. Manchester United. And I suspect it won't be Mr. Stephen Scragg. anyway, so I mean, before you tell us who your goalkeeper is, we'll just keep that under your hat for a moment. Just tell us, who came close with the goalkeeper?
This was the one where, when me and my dad were having the conversation, this was the only one that we agreed on unanimously. But there was one other player that came close, and that was Edwin van der Sar, who I think still holds the record for the most number of minutes played without conceding a goal. I remember it was in the 08-09 season where we sort of almost for about half the season between like December and March, we morphed into like Jose Mourinho's Chelsea and that we almost won every game 1-0. And he kept, I think it was 11 clean sheets on the bounce. So he's really unlucky not to go in, but really only because the guy that I've picked ahead of him, in my opinion, probably one of the best goalkeepers of all time. Otherwise, Edwin would probably have got the nod.
Yeah, I guess any listeners, and especially Manchester United fans, could probably guess who he did it go with. But before we sort of ask you to reveal that, I want you to ask Aidan, how close do you think Massimo Taibbi came to being?
I can't believe this, Gary. I've got a note to mention Massimo Taibbi as well. It's as though we've been copying notes here. I can't believe he didn't get a mention from those glorious four games for Man United.
Yeah. Imagine when you're a goalkeeper, such repute goals, and then so many of the, I mean, I don't know how many goalkeepers were tried in between, you know, before Schmeichel took over and Schmeichel and Van der Sar. And you're thinking, you know, it's that one position that is so key, and yet it seems so difficult to pick the right guy, doesn't it?
Sorry, I was going to say it was almost like one of Fergie's Achilles heels that he couldn't, I wouldn't say it was that he couldn't pick a good goalkeeper because he was very interested in Van der Sar after Schmeichel retired. He couldn't get Van der Sar, so he went through an absolute raft of dross before we did get Van der Sar.
Yeah. I suppose the only one who sort of was semi-permanent was Barthez. But, you know, there was such, as you say, so many players that sort of just sort of didn't.
And even Barthez, you're veering from the utterly reliable like Schmeichel to the slightly, how should we say, up and down, perhaps, if that's being kind of Barthez.
Very politically put.
Yeah, it doesn't give you quite the same level of security, does it?
I remember going to Old Trafford when Arsenal beat us 1-0 to win the league in 01-02.
Yes.
And the general feeling was that no one was confident with Barthez in goal, given that earlier in the season when they'd beaten us 3-1, Barthez had given the ball away twice to Thierry Henry, which had, like, in my household, led to some mutterings that it was like some sort of pact between Frenchmen that he was just giving him the ball repeatedly because it was disastrous. But he veered from being pretty solid to utterly ludicrous.
I guess other ones from further in the past, Gary, would be like Harry Gregg and Alex Stepney, wouldn't they?
The
ones that I'm guessing you remember a bit. Well, Alex Stepney probably more than Harry Gregg.
Alex Stepney was former Chelsea player before he went to Manchester United as well. Harry Gregg is a part time, but yeah, I mean, Stepney was played when United won the first European Cup, of course, as well. So, obviously, even pre-Ferguson times as well, with Mac Busby. And it's funny about goalkeepers, isn't it? You know, I mean, at the other end of the pitch, being forward, you almost don't mind a little bit of a magic touch, you know, and two mistakes and one goal. You know, but for the goalkeeper, you can't have that eccentricity. You can't have that, brilliant mistake. You've got to have a 9.9 out of 10 goalkeeper performance. If you want to be successful, it's such a key position, isn't it?
It's fundamental to have that rock, if you like, at the back. You have to have solid foundations for which everything else can flourish. You can have all the great attacking intent you like, but if you keep shipping them at the back, you're going to come unstuck sooner or later, as a Newcastle fan certainly knows when we're talking about Manchester United. But, you know, you're right, Gary, it's totally core to every great team that there is. Maybe not a 9.9 out of 10 in every great team, but every great successful team will have somebody who's right up at that level or there or thereabouts. You just have to. Otherwise, you know, an off day or a great goalkeeping or defensive performance at the other end, and you're going to be in trouble. But the greatest teams still find a way, and that might just be nicking one goal. But for that to work, you need to make sure the back line is absolutely secure.
So, Josh, present our misery. Reveal the least sort of surprising secrets of the evening. Who's your choice for a goalkeeper on Manchester United's Mount Rushmore, mate?
Well, it's obviously Peter Schmeichel, which I think is probably the choice of about 99.9% of Manchester United fans. For obvious reason as well. I mean, I grew up watching him, and as a kid, it felt like you couldn't actually beat him because he was just so big, but at the same time, so agile. And I think just the fact that he had such a commanding presence, which maybe goalkeepers nowadays don't necessarily have. Like, some of them don't need to. You think about Ederson at Manchester City. He's just so good with the ball that people trust him. He doesn't need to be barking at people and pushing them out of his way. But Schmeichel would just domineer everyone, from centre-backs he played with to centre-forwards that came up against him. And then just the whole fact that he innovated that sort of starfish jump, where he just took the view of that if you have the greatest surface area possible, your chance of stopping the ball is therefore greatly increased. So he just used to leap at people like a starfish. And if you've got like a 17-stone, 6-foot-5 man leaping at you with all his limbs all over the place, I can imagine it's quite terrifying when you're bearing down on goal.
Yeah, I mean, I remember you said that dominating presence. I remember, I can't remember which game, but I remember an instance when I think it was a cross hit that he's fumbled and dropped and scored it against. And Steve Bruce and Pallister were there at the time, and he laced into these two guys. They hadn't been involved. That was just typical Schmeichel. You know, I mean, he was just that angry that he conceded a goal. He absolutely lashed out. I think Steve Bruce and Pallister, and you know, sort of and others at the time, perhaps running on as well, they perhaps developed a sort of an ear infection that they couldn't hear very well at times. Yeah. Anyway, so Aidan, Peter Schmeichel. Pretty okay, fairly decent goalkeeper.
Fairly decent. I'm looking to
check,
about.
Of course, but you know, he's getting there.
Well, yes, I would rate him higher than Peter Cech, and I'm sure you would too, Gary. Once you'd really settled into it. What can you say about that? He was simply the best goalkeeper in the world for a period of time. I don't think there's much debate about that at that period of time through the 90s. He was infuriatingly good, so vocal and so terrifying, frankly, as Josh was talking about there. That star jump, it was iconic. I think it was adapted from his handball goalkeeping as a youth in Denmark. It's a quite a familiar sight in handball goalkeeping, and it's clearly something he brought into football and worked on it. I think, you know, ordinarily it would just leave it easy for people to tuck the ball under him. But as I say, I think everyone was just so utterly terrified by it that it put everybody off. It's despite not having any great love for Manchester United, there was always a begrudging admiration for Schmeichel and how good he was. You know, I said infuriatingly good, and I've got personal experience of that, obviously. His performance at St. James's Park in 1996, when Man United took everything Newcastle could give, held firm, and then won in the second half with Cantona. That has got to be the most frustrating thing I've ever seen following Newcastle United. You know, there were two key reasons we didn't win that game, and probably with it the league too. I think that, to me, was the most pivotal game. You can forget all the other more dramatic ones. This is the one that swung it because of who it was against. Obviously, Cantona was one key person with that goal, but more so than him, it was because of Schmeichel. The saves he made, so many of them and so good, they were remarkable at times. And it really, really annoyed me, obviously. It destroyed a dream for Newcastle, but there was a magnificence to it that I guess it's taken a little longer for me to fully appreciate that, but it was a simply brilliant display. I did quite enjoy the 5-0 that followed a few months later, I have to say. He wasn't so good that day, but, you know, they still won the league that year as well, didn't they? And had traded a couple of those goals that night for some a few months earlier, absolutely. But it wasn't a one-off for someone like him, and that's the thing. You know, that's just one hugely famous example of how infuriatingly good he was for fans of other teams and how magnificently good he was for Manchester United fans. He was exceptional so often. All the way back to Euro 92 as well, where obviously, you know, his heroics helped a heroic story for Denmark. But, you know, throughout his time with Manchester United, all the way up to the 1999 Champions League final. And he was, you know, a huge part of that throughout, not just in the final, you know, some of the very dramatic games in the run to that as well. I mean, what a player he was. And as you say, it took so long to find a suitable replacement. And I think that says a lot about him, about how utterly dominant he was. I think, you know, they've had similar issues on the managerial front as well. You know, when you've had such a dominant character for so long, and George Schmeichel wasn't quite as long as Ferguson, but it makes it an impossible act to follow. So it's almost like the people who followed more closely immediately after were slightly on a hiding to nothing, unless they were sheer world class. I don't just mean a sort of generic world class. I mean at the very tip of that particular peak. You had to be right up there to even stand any comparison to Schmeichel. And that's an impossible thing for virtually everybody, and definitely impossible for those who followed in the immediate time, even those who are World Cup winners themselves. And as you're totally right, it wasn't until Van der Sar came along and steadied things somewhat, and then had a decent lengthy spell himself, because he was so good as well. But you know, this is definitely the correct choice. Van der Sar was a fantastic goalie, but not on the level of Peter Schmeichel. I think very few people are. And I'm talking all time as well now. You know, he was the greatest in the world for a period of time, but that puts him as one of the greatest goalkeepers there's ever been. I do want to know, though, how it felt to see him playing for Manchester City. You know, it was odd to me to see him to play for anyone other than Manchester United or Denmark, of course. You know, he played a little bit at Aston Villa too, but Man City, really? You know, it was okay when he played, when he went to Portugal, I think, for a brief stint. You know, then it's a bit out of sight, out of mind, I imagine. But that's a little close to home, wasn't it, Josh?
Yeah, I remember as a kid absolutely despising him for turning up at City, especially because in the two games he played against us, he never lost. So he was never on the losing side. I think I'm right in saying he was never on the losing side of a Manchester derby in his entire career.
Wow.
He always won with United, and then won, and I think drew, or maybe even won both with City. But wow. I have to say, in recent years, like, he's appeared on the Man United podcast as well, and that's a really good listen, where he was on there for like 2 hours. And I think it's fair to say that he hates Manchester City. he was just like, you know, my family lived in Manchester for 8 years. I wanted to come back to England. Man United wouldn't have me because I was, what, 38 years old. He was like, so it just made sense to be able to live in the same area to play for Manchester City. And his argument at the time was Manchester City were crap. Manchester City were not going to be challenging Man United. In his mind, he was like, I wouldn't ever have a bearing on whether Manchester United won the league. Went back there, ruffled a few feathers, but then has in recent times said that, you know, the setup there was awful, the training was awful, the tactics were awful, the players weren't as nice. It was just not the same scenario as being at Manchester United. So he did sort of, you know, win a few brownie points back through his hatred of Manchester City. But yeah, at the time, it was horrible. It really was horrible.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I mean, somebody who sort of, I mean, remembers that the sort of, you know, Schmeichel arriving as literally an unknown player for any, you know, any but the most sort of knowledgeable of European football to become, you know, as this guy said, I think Petr Cech running class, but you know, Schmeichel is the guy that's not beat about the bush. And sometimes when he's playing, you almost think, this is not fair. It's like, it's, you know, it's just too good. It's just not fair. And, you know, Manchester United was won a lot of trophies when Schmeichel was there under Ferguson. And at the time, one of the great players of the league, Cantona. We'll talk about some of the players afterwards. But if you pick the one guy out of that team that you want for your team, if you don't pick Schmeichel, you're an idiot. I mean, it's just that perishing good, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was unbelievable. Even in 98-99, which was about the third season I can remember watching football and like properly paying attention to it. Throughout that season, it seems odd to say it, but especially in Europe, I always felt United were underdogs because we spent so much of our time coming from behind against teams. Like, with the exception of Bromby, who we thrashed like 5-0 and 6-2, we always either went 1-0 down to someone, had to fight our way back, or we made a meal out of it. And I remember him making an unbelievable save against Ivan Zamorano in the Inter game, where Zamorano had headed it into the bottom corner and he did his starfish. He caught it with his left hand. But there were several times throughout that season where it felt like Man United deserved to lose or were on the path to losing, and somehow Schmeichel averted danger. The other one I can really think of was when Phil Neville tripped Ray Parlour in the penalty box in the FA Cup semi-final replay. And then I remember when Bergkamp was stepping up, I was asking my dad, I was like, is Schmeichel a good penalty saver? And he was like, well, not that good. And then we were like, well, it's over, then Bergkamp's going to score. And then it was almost like ordained, like he was supposed to save it. Just so many times in that season, you felt like it was dead and buried and Schmeichel would keep you in it. And considering that was a team that had a lot of world-class footballers in, he was the standout one.
I mean, you know, as I said earlier, this is the least surprising. I was going through this morning, research this morning to do the players, and I was thinking about, okay, defenders, yeah, there's probably about 10 of them, 12 midfield players, a dozen strikers, one goalkeeper. Although I think Massimiliano Ibra should be, I don't know, honorable mention, but let's gloss over that. So Peter Schmeichel, first face on the Mount Rushmore, is going to be sitting above Old Trafford, just beyond Stratford End. I'm going to put the mountain there so everybody can see. We're going to move on to defenders. God, jeez, there's a rich treasure chest of talent here. So let's sort of do the same thing. So who came close, Josh?
So there was quite a few choices of who came close. Slightly before my time, but I still have vague memories of them, was obviously Bruce and Pallister, who in my head always came as a pair, very much like Rio and Vidic. They complemented each other. And obviously Rio and Vidic was another one that came close. But they always felt like two halves of a whole. Like Vidic was the one who would attack the ball, Rio would sweep up. Rio was the one that would carry the ball out from the back. Vidic was the one who'd spray those long diagonal balls. So it almost felt like you had two probably in their prime world-class defenders, but they were two halves to a whole, whereas the guy that I've chosen, I think, was the whole package. And then if you're also talking defenders, Gary Neville probably deserves a mention. I know, even by his own admission, he says he's not the most talented footballer in the world, but he made the most of what he had. Because I think my entire childhood and teenage years was filled with Gary Neville just on the overlap for David Beckham. And he was a solid defender as well, good leader. Then the fullbacks, my dad was beside himself that he couldn't fit Dennis Irwin in as well as another defender. Because he was like, Dennis Irwin is the greatest bargain that Manchester United ever bought. And I was old enough to remember Dennis Irwin as well, certainly when I first started watching Manchester United. And he was one of those players as well that was so consistent. I imagine for opposition wingers, infuriatingly consistent. Like he never gave you anything less than 8 out of 10. Could play on either flank, dead ball specialist. Yeah, he was absolutely brilliant in his prime. A mention probably to Patrice Evra as well. Was an eccentric character, but a good footballer. I also very much loved, even though Manchester United fans hate him, and I will defend him to this day, Gabriel Heinze, the Argentinian left-back. I absolutely adored him. I had shirts left, right and centre with Heinze 4 on the back, just because I loved Argentinians because of Batistuta growing up, Varane, all that sort of thing. So when we signed an Argentinian, I was like, this is going to be my guy. And then when it just turned out that he liked to kick lumps out of people left and right, I loved him even more. But then obviously the links to Liverpool soured it a bit. And then obviously the guy who came the closest but missed out, because he is obviously my all-time footballing hero, was Ronnie Johnson, who is my favourite footballer of all time. He'd never relinquished that position atop the mountain of my affection. And to be fair, I know a lot of people are like, why Ronnie Johnson? But, you know, the reasons for why I like Ronnie Johnson are fairly obscure, but, you know, he was a very, very good defender who was just beset by having terrible knees, is the best way to describe him.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's a litany of talent there. I mean, one of the centre backs, and obviously someone like David May as well, who was massively underrated for his time. And it was a successful part of the team. And I mean, you've reeled off all the names I jotted down. It's interesting. I mean, the guy you're going to talk about, would certainly have been in my sort of top three, but I think I might have gone for Rio just because I think it's your choice, but it's good to see, you know, that but, you know, there are so many players that came close. And as you say, you know, Rio and Vidic and Bruce and Pallister, they were sort of partners, whereas the guy you're going to talk about actually was probably a more complete player rather than half of a partnership. Aiden, what do you think about those? Would any of those get the Newcastle team, buddy, up to date? I mean, you've got loads of money, mate, now, so, I mean, you, Picking players you want to sign for centre half, mate.
We don't do defenders. We never have done, and we still won't. as evidenced by today's mauling in the other half of Manchester. What a list of incredible players. I mean, just to throw in a couple of names from the further past, obviously there's the likes of Bill Fuchs and Roger Byrne, who were both part of the Munich, the team at that time, and both died in the Munich disaster. I think they were both excellent defenders as well. Roger Byrne, the captain at the time, I think. Honourable mention to them. But I think in terms of ability and achievement, it's the more modern ones are the ones where we should be looking. I think just the stature of individuals and team as a whole, I think, elevates many of the people that Josh has been talking about above those from the further past. I was never that keen on Rio Ferdinand, I've got to say. I think it's just his personality put me off. I could appreciate the player, but I was just so irritated by the person. So give me Vidic over him any day. I think I preferred him. Bruce and Pallister, you're absolutely right to describe it as just a pair. The only time they weren't was when it came to international duty, of course, where Steve Bruce missed out, whereas Pallister got to be in it quite frequently at that time alongside Adams, usually, I think. But, you know, they were both fantastic and contributed in all sorts of ways to bringing Manchester United to the pinnacle in the early 90s. Gary Neville's another one that just irritates, doesn't he? But it infuriates in a way that it's because of the passion he had for the club, and that just winds other people up, I think, especially Liverpool fans, I would imagine. Honourable mention to Stephen Scragg again here, who might have had something to say about that. But I think that's possibly what wound people up about him. I think he was clearly a class act to come through so young, achieved international recognition so young as well, and to have been a mainstay throughout a lengthy period shows the quality that he had. And being a one-club man just adds to it, I think, from a Manchester United perspective. But, I think of those others that we mentioned, Vidic would have been my preference ahead of Ferdinand because he just...
I mean, in fairness, I have to say I was picking Ferdinand the player rather than Ferdinand the pundit.
See, Gary, if you ever remember the TV programme he did in 2006, just before the World Cup that year, of Rio's Mercs or whatever.
Pranks, yeah.
If you'd ever seen that, you'd never give him the time of day.
Okay, yeah. I'm pleased to say I didn't. And one of the great joys I get over here is when I watch European football, I don't see Rio Ferdinand on there or Michael Owen or the Manchester United or Liverpool mafia.
He was an irritating pundit during the Euros last summer as well, just predicting 3-4-0 wins for England left, right and centre.
So
I'm sure he jinxed the country.
Yeah. When we mentioned about goalkeepers, we talked about the problems replacing Schmeichel till Van der Sar came on. But with the centre-backs, it was almost, they had this sort of, they had Bruce and Pallister, but I think Ferguson used to call them Dolly and Daisy because they were like a double act of the old music hall. And then obviously Rio and Vidic. And so he had that sort of moving of the baton quite sort of efficiently. And this guy was certainly, would be in anybody's top half dozen defenders, Premiership defenders of all time. So who is it going to be, Josh?
Well, it's probably the one name that I've missed off, but in three seasons he spent at United, which is relatively brief when you consider the other people on that list. He won the Premier League three times, the FA Cup, the Champions League, and the Intercontinental Cup. And I know I'm biased, but I'd probably go so far as saying he's the best centre half I've ever seen in the Premier League. But Yap Stam, who to me epitomised what a centre back should be. Where I was saying earlier, sort of hinting at that Rio and Vidic and Pallister and Bruce were two halves of a whole, he was the whole. He was aggressive in the air because he was incredibly strong and incredibly tall. He could cover because he was deceptively quick for a guy that was 6'4". He could read the game insanely well. He didn't let anyone bully him. A lot of people I know these days will cite Van Dijk as being that sort of paragon by which they judge defenders because people just seem scared of him. But I remember even Brazilian Ronaldo was terrified of Yap Stam. Like when we played Inter, Ronaldo and Zamorano played up front, and neither of them wanted to go and stand on Yap Stam because he was just such a terrifying human being. Really nice guy off the pitch. I've listened to so many interviews with him. He's a really nice, well-spoken guy. But on it, even by his own admission, he says he's just a monster. He just wanted to win. And the fact that he was athletically dominant only seemed to complement the fact that he had a very good footballing brain and could play football as well. Because you tend to think of like big brutes like that being sort of like you win the ball and you get rid of it as far as possible. Whereas he had that ability to feed it into Scholes and Keane in the centre midfield. I suppose the only downside to his game was he didn't really score many. He scored one in 3 years at United against Leicester. The final in a 6-2 win, I think it was. Half volley from about 25 yards out. But other than that, he was pretty much, for the English game, because I know that if you were to head to Italy, like Baresi and Maldini are king. But for the English game at the time, I don't think there was anyone better suited to it than Yap Stam.
It's interesting. I remember I was at Villa Park, and it was one of, I'm not sure if it was his debut, but it was one of his early games for United after he signed. And United were winning 3-0, and it was in the last minute. And he got himself booked for a stupid, well, a rash challenge, shall we say. And I remember saying to the guy I was sort of the game, he's saying, I bet Ferguson's doing nuts here. The game's secure, and this guy's got booked. But actually, what it was a demonstration of Yap Stam determination not to concede a goal at any time in any game. And it was actually a real a boon for United, that attitude, rather than it being a sort of, don't, you know, what do I know? Ferguson could pick a mark on. So, you know, that's an interesting one. But yeah, Yap Stam. Interesting that the 3 years, that was pretty poor. He didn't win much silverware in those 3 years, did he? I mean, that, you know, you want to sort of shake yourself up. I mean, that's a career haul. If anybody has played 15 years, 12 years, the top rank, and has got three Premier League trophies, Champions League, Intercontinental, and an FA Cup, you think, I've had a pretty good career. But this guy did that in 3 years. Wow. Aiden, would he get a go for Newcastle?
Just a bit, yeah. Only got most of those just in his first year, didn't he, with the treble, and then the Intercontinental Cup followed soon after. But yeah, winning the Premier League in each of his three seasons is quite some feat. I describe Schmeichel as being a bit terrifying. Well, I think the same could definitely apply to Yap Stam. He just had a look of someone you don't want to mess with, and then played in that way as well. You know, I speak as a fellow follically challenged person. One thing me and Yap Stam have in common is that neither of us would look right with hair. And I think he just looks like the kind of person who probably never had hair. I just can't imagine it beyond a very close crop. It's the only thing that would have suited his approach, his style, and apparent footballing outlook. It just is right. You know, it's just the perfect look for his character, demeanor, style of play, and everything. You know, he was ferocious and excellently superb as well at doing it. You know, the comparisons between me and him don't really go much beyond that, I have to say. But I guess recalling his penalty for the Dutch in the Euro 2000 finals against Italy, I might have at least hit the target, whereas we all knew he was going to smash it way over the bar, but I guess mine would have been saved. So I guess, yeah, end result. When he and Ferguson had their falling out and he was gone, I think this must be something that's looked back on as a bit of a, I don't want to say turning point, because Manchester United didn't do that badly following it. But it's probably one of the few decisions that maybe you can question a little bit of whether it was the right thing, or whether, I guess Ferguson wasn't one to tolerate these fallings out. Stam wasn't the only one to fall foul of it, certainly. But whether the lack of alternatives of being that good in that particular style meant they should have dealt with it differently, I don't know. Maybe that would have undermined Ferguson's approach. So maybe that's not the best thing to have happened. But it must have been a huge disappointment for Manchester United fans. But for the rest of us, it was a huge, huge relief. And I think that tells you an awful lot about his ability.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, I've mentioned this a little bit a couple of times. I know it was the Celtic one with Billy McNeil, and I think it was one quite recently, but I'm going to break a few chisels carving Yap Stam into that mountain, because that guy was rock hard, was absolutely rock hard. So yeah, I think Yapstam right along there alongside Schmeichel. I mean, there's a bit debatable ones, but yeah, you can't argue with the choice. Certainly worthy of being immortalised and much more now. I mean, these next two categories, I mean, you know, if you sort of talked about seven or eight defenders there, you could probably pick 15, 20 players in these next couple of categories. So this is going to be fascinating moving on. So for you, Josh, who came close in midfield? Who came close?
Yeah, this one, I'd say midfield and forwards were the hardest two. So when I chatted to my dad, the one that he would have had in there without question was George Best, which, I mean, it probably is Mr. Man United. He's the footballer I most associate with Manchester United. And my dad will insist that he is the greatest footballer of all time. And I know I grew up on like old grainy videos of my dad having like take match of the day from the 60s and 70s of like George Best just running around people trying to hack him to bits on literal quagmires on occasions. So I had to cut George Best out sadly just because of my own self-imposed rules of picking players that I'd seen. But then that still left an awful lot to whittle down. Ryan Giggs being an obvious one. I suppose difficult with Ryan Giggs because his career was very much cut in two. When I was younger, he was the flying winger who, you know, had troublesome hamstrings that would sprint past people and slalom past defenders. And then in my later years, he was something, I wouldn't say a cultured playmaker, but he became more of a centre midfielder that would recycle and use the ball. But simply the fact that he played in, I think, was it 21 Premier League seasons? Or no, because then he started in the old First Division, didn't he? So I think it was 21 consecutive seasons or something he played for Man United, scoring in as well. Means that he has to be close to making the list. On the opposite flank, obviously Beckham as well, who even when I was a kid, I remember we went on a football tournament to the Netherlands, so we had to go across on the Channel Ferry, and I was wearing a Man United shirt, and some massive Geordie strolled past me and told me in no uncertain terms that David Beckham was shite. And I remember thinking, like, who doesn't rate David Beckham? As like a 9-year-old, I was thinking, like, everyone rates David Beckham, don't they? And I think even to this day that he gets an unfair rap, that people look at him and they're like, oh, he was haircuts and Victoria Beckham and going to play for LA Galaxy. But people forget that in his prime, for about 4 or 5 years, there was no one better at crossing a ball in world football than him. No one better at hitting a free kick or a dead ball. So he was unlucky not to make the list. The other very, very obvious one is obviously Keno, who is another player that you could say is a Mr. Man United. Even to this day, I judge current Man United players on whether or not Roy Keane would tolerate playing alongside them. If the answer is yes, then they're fine by me. If the answer is no, then they shouldn't be playing for Manchester United. He was just everything that I grew to expect as a captain. He led by example. He was the first to defend his teammates on a football pitch. He was, as you could say, he was probably, even maybe for the 90s and noughties, he was overly aggressive, like the amount of red cards he got. But it always felt like when Roy Keane got a red card, it was never a case of bemoaning or lamenting the fact that we were down to 10 men. It was, well, Roy Keane had a course of action that he needed to take, and by God, he was the man that was going to do it. Whereas these days, you know, Pogba gets a red card, and because I was at the United game and we lost 5-0, and I was screaming blue murder when Pogba got sent off. I mean, if that had been Roy Keane, I'd have been like, good for you, Keane, you should have done that. Roy Keane earned that leeway. But yeah, he's very, very unlucky not to get in there. And then it depends on how you classify midfielders, because you could go into wingers as well. But I'll probably put those in forwards. And then probably one last one to mention that I did consider was Michael Carrick as well, who was, I think, a very, very underrated footballer. Probably should have got more caps for England. One of those midfielders, I think, where in sort of like the late 90s, early noughties, where English football was very much about blood and thunder, box-to-box midfielders, because, you know, Keane was a box-to-box, Vieira box-to-box, Gerrard, Lampard, you know, they were all action, they were up and down. Michael Carrick felt very continental in his approach. He would sit in front of the back four, he would recycle the ball, he would never, ever give it away. He wouldn't necessarily, I guess the way to describe Michael Carrick is that he'd always play percentages. He He wouldn't go for a risky board if it wasn't necessary. He was like a Javi or an Iniesta, but English. So those were probably the ones that made it the closest that I could think of in my time. Yeah, which probably only leaves one obvious person who's made my list.
Just before I pass on to Ed, a couple of things to mention there. I mean, I think Carrick's a really good mention. I mean, it sort of put me in the mind very much of Ray Wilkins sort of player. And, the Spanish guy who played at Liverpool.
Javi Alonso?
Yes, yeah. It's very much sort of, you know, you find a guy wearing the same colour shirt. It's a great talent, and give them the ball. Carrick's mentioned. It's interesting, you know, I mentioned George Best. I mean, I don't think we could do a part about Manchester United with their sort of lauded George Best, so I'm going to do it here. I'm fortunate at my age sort of, to live through an era where I've seen some of the world's greatest players play. I mean, Cruyff, Messi, both Ronaldos, Ronaldinho. I don't know if it's called Pele or Maradona, but they're probably the only ones missing. And George Best fits right in that group. It's difficult to compare, say, who's the best because there's lots of different types of players, but Best was a phenomenal player, absolutely phenomenal. And just to explain why that Geordie slated you for Beckham, you didn't realise perhaps, but they had Dwight Gale there. So, Aidan, the list that we've got.
I was just thinking back through my own past travels to make sure that it wasn't me on that boat. I don't think it was.
It was you and your Yapstam persona.
Terrifying.
I mean, what a list. What a list of players who didn't
make
it.
That's just it. Yeah, that's just it. We've been going on for several minutes about all sorts of players who would be fully justified being picked. And that's just pretty much the more recent ones. We haven't even delved into some of the other, all of the great. Obviously, we talk about George Best, but there's various others from further back that you could even think of as well. Nobby Styles is obviously a competitive midfielder who is synonymous with Manchester United. Paul Ince, I guess, although maybe that was sullied from his time at Liverpool from a Manchester United perspective. But, you know, during that period of time in the early 90s, he was absolutely terrific for Manchester United. Brian Robson is another one, utterly synonymous, I guess, with the club as well in terms of his peak and prime. I don't know whether we class Bobby Charlton as a midfielder or a forward, so I'll just leave that one hanging. But you're absolutely right about Michael Carrick. I think he probably still talks about the day he met me in the bar at Newcastle Airport. But beyond that, he was superb, but misunderstood, as you say. The way he kept the ball so well, it just wasn't what English football was ready for at that time. It was a continental thing, and we've kind of caught up on that aspect now in terms of appreciating it. Maybe the crowd still always want people to go forwards more. The Ray Wilkins comparison is perfect because that's exactly what everyone used to say about him. That he passed sideways and everything was sideways and sideways. Well, he was passing to his teammates so that space could develop and things would get moved around. You know, there was always a purpose to it. And that's what all the possession is about. And Michael Carrick was excellent at that. Hugely underappreciated and misunderstood, I think, in terms of his style. He could have given more if he'd been given the chance to at various stages, but I'm probably talking internationally more so than at his club, where I think for Manchester United, he was hugely appreciated. The David Beckham thing is really, really interesting, what Josh was saying there, because I think all the glitz and glamour has blinded a lot of people to his talent. And, you know, the whole sort of courting the limelight with his wife and so on, I think that just turns people off when we're talking about football fans as opposed to celebrity fans, to ignore what a good player he was. And he was absolutely superb. He was terrific. And there was a period of time where, as you say, that his crosses were as good as it got. And you know, it just caused havoc. I don't know what makes a cross so much better than someone else's cross. The trajectory, the speed, and all of those things combined together. But, he had it. He worked at it so hard. He had natural ability that he then enhanced in the same way that Cristiano Ronaldo has. You know, terrific natural ability, but this incredible work ethic to make sure that despite all those advantages you've naturally got, you make even more of it, if that's at all possible. And I think Beckham was very much like that as well. Incidentally, from my time in Japan, Beckham was so, so loved over there. I was there. It was about 4 years after the World Cup in Japan, but they hadn't got over Beckham mania by that point. Every time that you talk to people and established where I was from, Beckham was the one that always got a mention. It was incredible, the love for him internationally. And that isn't based on celebrity fame. That's based on who he played for, in part, England and Manchester United, but to stand out as well for his abilities. So, yeah, so many to pick from. Duncan Edwards is another name I could throw in from the past as well. Short-lived career, obviously, but he's the player that Bobby Charlton cited as the greatest he ever saw.
I'm glad you brought up Duncan Edwards, because that was another one that me and my dad talked about, because my granddad played against him. He would have been playing for possibly Barnard's Green in Malvern, and because obviously Duncan Edwards was from Dudley. And my granddad, who's now passed away, used to tell this infuriating anecdote to everyone he met, that he'd go, "Oh, I've played against Duncan Edwards." And they'd go, "Really, did you?" And he's like, "Well, I thought it was Duncan Edwards. I couldn't actually get close enough to check." in my granddad's recollection, he was like, "You could not get near the man." He was like, and even then, he's like, he wasn't a man, he was a boy, because he was only 17 or 18 at the time. He said, and he was untouchable. Absolutely untouchable. Because my granddad played for Liverpool. He got up through their C team, B team, up to their reserve team, but he was an indentured apprentice at the time. And his carpentry apprentice, they wouldn't let him break his apprenticeship to go and play for Liverpool. So he ended up playing for Worcester City and Aldershot Town, Malvern Town, all these sorts of teams. But he played for Liverpool, and he said that of all the players that he played against, Duncan Edwards was by far the best that he played against. And he says in all the years that he had watched football, he died in 2011, he said no one came close to Duncan Edwards. He was like, he was just the biggest, strongest, fastest, fittest, best with the ball, best at everything. So he sort of echoed what Bobby Charlton said. I think Bobby Charlton said Duncan Edwards was the only player that made him feel inferior.
Yeah. Which is quite something.
tragic loss. Yeah, but as with so many, that been such a major disaster. We've gone through. Literally stellar names there. Stellar names. So this guy is going to have to be some player to get to oust that collection. So tell us who it is, Josh.
Well, it's a guy that often gets brought up in the Lampard and Gerrard debate, but it's obviously Paul Scholes, who. To me, growing up as a Manchester United fan, was largely, I think, flew under the radar a little bit, especially in sort of like the treble season, which so many people look back on fondly. You know, people think of York and Cole, or they think of Keane, especially with his semi-final exploits against Juve, or they think of Giggs and his flying runs, or Beckham and his set pieces, and that Scholes almost got overlooked in my earlier years, and then sort of matured into this really, really renowned playmaker that a lot of later playmakers that came cited him as being, you know, the archetype. He was just one of those players that made football look inherently easy. You look at someone like Ronaldo, who obviously played with Scholes for a number of years, and Ronaldo was everything that Scholes wasn't. You know, he was athletic, fit, run, jump. He could do all the things that make footballers athletes that Scholes couldn't do. But Scholes just had such a, like a, almost like a bewitchment over the ball. He could do whatever he wanted to do with the ball, no matter what, he could pull it off. Like, he could hit 30, 40-yard diagonals. He could smash them in the top bin from 30 or 40 yards. He could arrive late in the box and score goals. He was just used to playing triangles all the time. You always pass and move, pass and move, pass and move, especially with Keane in tandem. I just think he was one of those players that, he's entered that sort of like weird dichotomy where people either think he's underrated or overrated. And it's generally Man United fans think he's underrated and everyone else thinks he's overrated. Whereas I just think that he's just one of those footballers that is, I don't know, sometimes in this world that's obsessed with stats, he's quite hard to quantify because he didn't score as many goals as Gerrard and Lampard, and he didn't get as many assists as Kevin De Bruyne. But if you asked me which one I'd rather have in my team, it would be Paul Scholes. There's almost something unquantifiable about the way that he played, that he would just, I don't know, it was just mesmeric watching him pass the ball. I can rarely remember him giving it away, except when he came out of retirement against City in the FA Cup, and when he came on, we were 3-0 up, and by the time he'd been on the pitch for 5 minutes, we were only 3-2 up, because he'd given the ball away twice. There's the only two times I can remember him giving the ball away. But yeah, to beat out people like Keane, Duncan Edwards, Brian Robson, David Beckham, I think you've got to be one of the greatest midfielders of his generation, if not probably one of England's greatest midfielders of all time.
Yeah, I might have this wrong, but I think it was Messi that said that Scholes was his favourite player. I might have that wrong, but it was somebody of that ilk.
I think it might have been Zidane.
Well, it was Zidane. Oh, thanks, Aidan. Yeah, it probably was Zidane. Yeah, I mean, that is some acclamation of a player of that magnitude. And it's interesting you mentioned about the sort of the era when Scholes and Gerrard and Lampard were all in the pomp, and Scholes certainly in the international state seemed to be the guy that sort of missed out, being shunted out to a wide position. And I mean, I'm going to get the stable there and get my hobby horse out, because I'm going to jump on it here. Because, I mean, the England managers who said, you know, it's a problem having three players of that capability. Are you having a giraffe? I mean, any international manager, club manager worth their salt would be able to find a way of making those three players work. And what a midfield England were denied over so many years, when, you know, it was either one, it was two or three, you know, permanently two from three, but, you know, there you go. And Scholes was a totally different player, as you mentioned, to Gerrard Lampard. Not the all-action, up and down, box-to-box, scoring of many goals. But yeah, what a talent to pick a pass. But to see a pass first, and then to sort of deliver it with unerring accuracy over time, I mean, stunning quality. What do you reckon to Scholes tonight?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely the sort of quiet genius, and I think that's what hid him away a little bit at times from people's view, because he wasn't that all-action type, and his personality wasn't that type as well. You know, he was incredibly talented. His reading of the game, vision, he popped up with some really excellent and decisive goals as well. Less said about his tackling ability, the better, I think, and that's probably his one flaw. As you say, often cited by many beyond the UK as England's finest player in an era where he was shunted out left to keep the Lampard-Gerrard pairing. And as you say, it wasn't as if he was shunted out left for something that worked necessarily, because it never did. They should have found a better way to incorporate them all. But for Manchester United, obviously he's one of those that came through the class of 92 alongside Beckham, Neville and so on. Stayed with the club his whole career. It's clearly a club he had a love for throughout his life and time there. I just think the only reason he wasn't so appreciated is because of his manner and personality. I don't say not appreciated, that's not correct. Appreciated to the extent that he should have been, I think is the better way of putting it. Similar things to what we're talking about Carrick probably apply here as well, in terms of the style was more continental. And I guess that's borne out by the likes of Zidane and others making such comments about him as being their number one English midfielder, whereas we were all still obsessed with the whole Gerrard Lampard situation. It is to do with the style and approach and mannerisms that different nationalities, I guess, see easier and appreciate better because we can easily see what Gerrard or Lampard can bring to the table in terms of the dynamism, the barnstorming nature, the last gasp heroics, and the frequent goals. Whereas Paul Scholes wasn't quite that player in that style. But that, I think that's just that we as a nation were possibly not wired to appreciate that quite as well, whereas others were, and possibly valued him higher than they would do Lampard or Gerrard. I think what Josh said earlier about some people see him as being overappreciated, some as underappreciated now, I think that's a little unfortunate, but I guess that's because at the time, I think he was widely underappreciated beyond Manchester in terms of, for the level he was at. I don't mean that we don't appreciate he was a good player. Obviously, I think everyone could see that, but to the level it should have been, I think. So therefore, it's kind of slipped the other way. The praise gets heaped on, and that then people go back and look at, well, he wasn't as good as everyone's saying, quite like that. But, you know, he really was truly exceptional. He was a class act. He really was a class act. In a team where to stand out, you had to be a class act, obviously. I think the tackling is the only thing you'd ever hold against him, but that's just the flaw that makes him real. Everything else about him was sheer class. And he won 10 Premier Leagues. 10. I mean, that's just ridiculous. How can one player win 10? And maybe Giggs has won even more, I'm not sure. But 10 Premier Leagues is just insane. Absolutely insane. I mean, what an achievement.
He's actually won 11.
Sorry, 11. I ran out of fingers.
He came out of retirement for that last one, though, to be fair.
Okay.
And all joking aside, I mean, you know, 11 Premier League titles is probably more than any other club. That's allowing to play the Manchester United, would that be right? I think it's probably true, isn't it? Arsenal might come close. I mean, Chelsea have only won six or seven, perhaps.
Well, Liverpool have obviously the only other one.
Liverpool certainly not only one.
I mean, well, in Premier Leagues, obviously, yeah. But yeah. I mean, it's just astonishing.
I mean, it's stunning, absolutely stunning. So yeah, let's put skulls on Mount Rushmore. Before we start moving on to the forwards, I'm just going to give Josh fair warning, because before we discuss the forwards, I'm going to ask him to tell us who his dad's choices were, because that's going to be a little interesting little sideline to consider at the end. So follow the same format, Josh. We've got another lucky dip to stick our hand in and see who comes out here. Who was close in the forward line?
Wow, so this one was incredibly difficult again. Obviously, by my own rules, I ruled out people that I hadn't seen, which meant that someone like Dennis Law was unlucky not to even get considered the king. You don't get called the king at Manchester United unless you're good. And then by the same token, and it was where do I put Bobby Charlton? But I considered him somewhat of a forward. So he was unlucky not to get in, because he's also one that I think a lot of people associate as being a Mr. Man United. I think I've said 3 or 4 times, but maybe we were just fortunate to have a lot of players that were associated with Manchester United for so long and achieved so much that they became synonymous with the club. And Bobby Charlton is definitely synonymous with Manchester United. But unfortunately ruled him out because of my own rules, which also ruled out one of my dad's favourite ever players in Mark Hughes. He was spitting feathers when I told him that Mark Hughes couldn't even make the list for me. He was obviously a tremendous centre forward, not necessarily a very prolific centre forward, but definitely more of a facilitator. I think I remember someone describing to me once, it might even have been my dad, as being a scorer of great goals, more than anything else, because his ability to hit a volley was second to none. And then the other man that most Manchester United fans, I think, would include, but he came slightly before my time. I don't have a memory of ever seeing him play. It was obviously Eric Cantona, who I remember because I used to subscribe to the Manchester United magazine when I was a kid. And I think in 1999-2000, there was a poll of all the readers who was the best Manchester United player. And Eric Cantona came out on top ahead of George Best. And obviously, if you beat out George Best to being Manchester United's greatest ever player, then you are someone of considerable talent. Also, like the way that Eric Cantona was just so irascible in the way that he played. He didn't suffer fools gladly. I know there was a few question marks over his ability to do it in Europe, because that early Manchester United team, you know, sort of in the first sort of footings of the Premier League, never really got that far in Europe when you consider the players we had. Although I would say we were hamstrung somewhat by the fact that there was the 3 European player rule. Which often meant that one of our European players, like Schmeichel or Cantona, or Kanchelskis, had to be dropped. So Cantona was very, very close. And then going into the era that I grew up in, Colin York, very honourable mentions. But again, a bit like Rio and Vidic and Pallister and Bruce, they felt more like a double act than anything else. Even though Cole was there for several years before York, it was only really when York came that his goal scoring took off properly. But those two were fantastic when I was growing up. That goal against Barcelona, where they were pretty much operating on a level of telepathy that's like unknown to human beings before, was unbelievable. And then the next in that sort of line of forwards that probably should get a mention is Ruud van Nistelrooy, who was very, very much a hero of mine growing up. My brother, in fact, when we were growing up, had van Nistelrooy on the back of all of his shirts because he was just the most predatory centre forward I've ever seen. When you look at also, I don't want to compare him with centre forwards, but when you look at the amount of shots that someone like Ronaldo takes to score the amount of goals that he does, and then you look back at Van Nistelrooy and you realise that his efficiency was unbelievable. Like, he would get himself in goal scoring opportunities so you could take a shot. He wasn't one of those players that would pepper the goal with 10 or 11 shots hoping that one would go in. He picked his moments, and because his off the ball movement was just exceptional, more often than not, he was in a position to score simply because he was too clever for the defenders or too strong or too fast. So he's very unlucky to miss out. Another Dutchman, Robin van Persie, would have absolutely made the list, just for the 2012-13 season alone, where he pretty much won us the title, because that team we had that year was absolutely awful. It was garbage. But van Persie was the only reason we won the league, pretty much. And then another one of my absolute favourites, who I still love to this day, even though United fans actually test him, Carlos Tevez. He was one of those guys where I grew up playing Pro Evolution Soccer and Championship Manager to death. And I discovered him when I was like 12 or 13 years old playing for Boca. And I just used to consume so many YouTube clips of Carlos Tevez playing for Boca and then Corinthians. And I was like, if this guy ever turns up at Manchester United, I am going to lose my mind. And then when he did, I went straight out with my dad. I was like, we have to get a Tevez shirt. And then obviously he betrayed us 2 years later, but doesn't matter. The love was sealed. Carlos Tevez is welcome back at Old Trafford anytime in my book. He was just a fundamentally brilliant footballer and very, very similar to the man that I've chosen in the way that he played. He was that sort of like dogged pit bull, would not give anyone a moment's rest, but was just so technically gifted at the same time. And then the other man that obviously needs a mention is Cristiano Ronaldo, who is a difficult one because I omitted him simply because the player that I did put in has it in terms of longevity. But in terms of just raw footballing talent and just supreme ability, Ronaldo is probably the best I've ever seen at Manchester United. But he was only there for 6 years. And really, the first 3 years were his foundation. You know, he gave the ball away an awful lot. I remember screaming at the TV or shouting from the stands at Ronaldo for giving the ball away as often as he did. But then the second 3 years, he just morphed into this unstoppable goal-scoring machine. And then obviously, we know that when he went off to Real Madrid, he probably staked his claim for one of the greatest of all time. So yeah, he was the other man that got very, very, very close to being in my team. But I know that's a long litany of speakers, but...
There's no need to apologise for that, mate. That's good. I mean, Ronaldo's one of those players, you know, you sort of hear people talk about continental forwards. You know, what can he do is on a wet night at Stoke-on-Trent. Well, Ronaldo, not only could he do it, he did do it on a wet night at Stoke-on-Trent several times. So, you know, that's the thing. The only one guy I've got on my list here that you didn't mention, and it was Teddy Sheringham. Although he was perhaps, because of his sort of demeanour and his way of play, was never going to be going to the selection, but such a sort of unselfish player, that sort of an ideal Robin to somebody else's Batman, as it were. The sidekick. But some great names there, Aidan. I mean, strikers that and Ronaldo doesn't get the nod. So how good is that list of players?
Yeah, this is just greedy. Let's be honest, this isn't fair to everybody else, is it? Incredible list again. The mere fact that we're sort of scratching around for who else to add in that Josh hasn't mentioned there is, it just shows what an incredible list of people it's taken several minutes to get through, and we still haven't got onto who the main one is yet, who will have plenty to talk about as well, because there have been such great players already. I think the mention of Mark Hughes is really, really good, because I vividly remember his fabulous thumping winner in the Cup Winners' Cup final, 91, I'm guessing, I think, against Barcelona. And that was sort of, again, part of the rise of the club at that time. You know, this is pre league title at this point still. And, you know, this was a club who hadn't fully found its place yet at the top. Well, it simply wasn't at that stage. It was still climbing and getting there. And that seemed to signal to me a sort of arrival and a belief, I think, that it sort of instigated. And it took another couple of seasons to win, to actually win the league. But I think that was another significant step on the way that gave the club a huge belief and gave belief in what Ferguson was doing. So a hugely pivotal moment, but you know, clearly not as good a player overall as some of these others we're talking about. I guess from a similar standpoint, and I'm not suggesting that he should be the pick at all, but Solskjaer probably fits in the sort of cult hero bracket for what he did in 1999 in particular, but you know, frequently coming off the bench and making a difference. That was, you know, cult hero status rather than Mount Rushmore status, I guess. And going back to Cantona, you know, I talked about him earlier, how, you know, he destroyed my hopes and all that kind of stuff. But he's the kind of player who I love overall, you know, the sort of slightly unpredictable nature, the always on the edge, but you just know something's going to happen that's worth watching one way or another. Maybe that's leaping into the crowd and giving somebody a kicking who deserves it, or whether it's some absolute majesty on the pitch. The goal, the sort of chip goal he got against Sunderland, I think it was, where he just sort of stood there, arms out, and spun on the spot a bit, just taking in the applause. I mean, that, some people who weren't Man United fans would probably just get quite annoyed at the arrogance of that. But to me, that just, I quite like that. And it wasn't just because it was against Sunderland. I like the fact that he was taken in the adoration like that. I like that edge to a player. I like that arrogance when it's totally based in reality as well. You know, if you can do these things, why not soak up the adoration when it comes? He was unpredictable in so many ways, but always predictably good. I think they still sing his song at the Man United fans, which tells you an awful lot of the influence he's had on what modern Manchester United is. He was the final piece in the jigsaw, I guess, that finally got them over the line to win the Premier League, having won it the year before with Leeds, or First Division as it was there. So influential on the rise. He's kind of pushed them to the pinnacle and kept them there during the next few years as well. The club itself then progressed on from that. I think it became much bigger than it was at that point, and has gone to greater achievements, obviously, after his time. But it can't be understated the influence he had on that rise. I think he was the final piece of the jigsaw, and truly, truly great player. Another mark of greatness is the fact that he quit before many other people wanted him to. I think that stands him out for greatness as well. Quit when you're still great is a good thing in my book, rather than grow old disgracefully. But again, all right, wow, so many names to go through. It's just astonishing. And we've still got one more to come, one more big name.
We have. And given those names we've discussed, I mean, there's always a thing with Mount Rushmore that people like different types of players, and there's no good or bad. It's not right or wrong. It's just the sort of players that people take to their hearts. And the guy we're going to talk about now would probably hit all the bills, though, tick every box. Phenomenal goal scorer, as Josh said, always gave his best, and you know, a dog in the game. Winning was so important. So, just reveal your scouse hero then, Josh.
Yeah, so it's Wayne Rooney, obviously, who even when I picked him, I had a long internal battle as to whether I should pick Wayne Rooney. Not because he's a scouser, but just because I don't know, he's such a multifaceted person and footballer. You know, he's at the same time our record goal scorer, but also a man who twice asked to leave the club because he didn't think it was going in the direction that he wanted it to. Because I was livid with him in 2010-11 when that whole contract situation kicked off. Because I was thinking, like, you know, you're at biggest club in England, one of the biggest clubs in the world. You're our best player, our talisman. And he was throwing his toys out the pram and wanting to leave. But then at the same time, he is a man that I think probably stymied his own individual progress as a footballer simply for the betterment of Manchester United. And I don't think there are many footballers of his ilk that have ever done that. Because when you talk about Wayne Rooney, you know, when he burst on the scene, to use that phrase that Michael Richards loves, when he was 16 and he scored that goal against Arsenal for Everton, and you just thought, like, this is a man, this is a boy that's playing like a man who's only 16 at the time. And then when he joined Man United, it was in that sort of transitional period where the old guard of like Keane, Van Nistelrooy and Beckham and all that sort of, but had been shifted out, and we were sort of building towards what would become the next sort of trio of championship wins that was born off the back of Rooney and Ronaldo and Carrick and these slightly younger players. And you always knew there was something special about him. And the scary thing about Wayne Rooney that is that he's England's all-time leading goal scorer. He's Man United's all-time leading goal scorer. He's won like six Premier League titles. He's won the FA Cup, you know, I think might have been only the once. He's won Champions League. He's basically won everything there is to have won. And I still think he could have been better than he was. When you talk about Wayne Rooney, when he was a young footballer coming through at Manchester United in his sort of early 20s, in my mind, I was like, this is going to be the guy that should be at the pinnacle of world football for years to come. And when Messi got there and Ronaldo got there, even to this day, I will argue blue in the face that if Wayne Rooney had been a more selfish footballer, he would have been up there with Messi and Ronaldo. I'm not saying he's as good as Messi in terms of his ability on the ball, because I don't think anyone in the history of football is. But he just had that sort of raw ability with the football, that unpredictability like Cantona had, this sort of like chaos manifest on the pitch where you were like, is he going to headbutt someone or is he going to score a 40-yard volley? Like, you never knew what he was going to do. And I think it was just the fact that he said, you know what, if you need me to play on left midfield because it balances the team out, I'll play on left midfield. Or if you need me to do a shift in centre midfield, or if you need me to go out on the right wing so you can put Ronaldo on the left so he can come in on his right foot. He would do anything that meant that Manchester United won a football game. And that was what stopped him being, I think, probably a generational talent. And I think also this ability of his to just run himself into the ground for the cause of Manchester United from when he was, what, 18 years old, meant that by the time he was 29, 30, that was a man that had covered 10, 12,000 kilometres every game for over a decade. And his body was just shot, because the last couple of years at Manchester United were, he just sort of limped to a slow finish. He managed to get the goal tally, took him past Bobby Charlton, and then sort of just faded and went off to Everton. But I think a lot of younger supporters don't quite appreciate just how monumentally good Wayne Rooney was, and that he still could have been better. It's just a thing that baffles me to this day. You just look at him where he used to tear AC Milan apart. That goal against Bolton where him and Ronaldo just basically ran the length of the pitch in about 6 seconds and he dinked it over the keeper. That volley against Newcastle. He just like, and this was a guy as well that by his own admission just hated playing up front. This was a guy in the two seasons where he played up front as a lone striker, scored 53 Premier League goals, but he hated it because he just wanted to be on the ball all the time. He was like a kid that never really grew up, playing out in the, you know, in the street or on like the local recce, just being like, no, I don't want to just goal hang. Put me in centre midfield and I'll just take the ball and I'll dribble it left, I'll dribble it right, I'll play out there. I want to be involved in everything. And I don't know, there was just like so much beauty and chaos and violence to Wayne Rooney that I don't know if there's anyone that's been quite synonymous with him. I think he's just a unique footballer. And I know that he's very divisive amongst Man United fans. Again, not because he's a Scouser, but just because of the way that he left a bit of a sour taste in our mouths at times. But there was no doubting that he was just one of the greatest footballers we've ever had.
Yeah. Something about Wayne Rooney. I mean, we mentioned earlier about Duncan Edwards, and I think Bobby Charlton said something like he was a man, like a man playing in a boy's game, although he was the boy. And I saw Rooney, another game was at a park in the Man United visit there, and it was quite early in Rooney's Man United career, and he was the same sort of thing. He looked bigger, although he wasn't. He looked stronger, although he wasn't. He just looked like somebody's dad had turned up in a kid's game. It was that sort of dominant. And you mentioned about his enthusiasm. And I remember when he's sort of on the bench, you know, and Ferguson's there. You can imagine him nagging Ferguson, "Put me on, boss. Boss, put me on, boss. You know, I'll change the game," and all that sort of thing. And two goals stick in my mind, the Newcastle one. And the chaos theory. And he's bragging the referee about the decision. And he looks that angry. He starts taking out on the ball when it comes across. He's I'm the referee, and then so the ball comes across. Well, Cobblers, guys, this ball's having it now. And away he went, buried into the net. And the other goal, of course, is perhaps one of the best Premiership goals of the Premiership era, is the scissor kick against City. I mean, just, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, you can do that or you can't. You can see that or you can't. You can perform it. You can't coach that. You know, that's a natural talent. So Wayne Rooney, let's forget the Newcastle goal, unless you want to bring it to Biden. But aside from that, what about Wayne Rooney?
I've seen enough goals against Newcastle to be able to appreciate the good ones in amongst all the huge amount of other ones. I'm sure our friend and colleague Paul McParland would have a few views on Rooney from his startling breakthrough with Everton, obviously. But without wanting to insult Paul or Everton, I think it was clear he was destined for bigger things. He found a second home at Old Trafford, I think. You know, he was obviously comfortable in his Everton environment and he went back there. But I think he felt equally at home for large periods, maybe not the entire time, as Josh was talking about, but for large periods at Old Trafford. You know, from that explosive beginning with a hat-trick against Fenerbahce, aged 18, which is one way to signal the arrival, isn't it? Through a host of other goals, I mean, spectacular or straightforward. You mentioned the Newcastle one and that City one. I mean, that must have been particularly sweet, of course, for Man United fans. And that's a way to embed yourself in their favour, certainly. I wonder if for the rest of us, I was thinking on this, about whether he doesn't get full credit he deserves at times, because often I think he became at times a focus of a bit of irritation or complaint when it came to the national team. Unfairly, I might add, but I think the media pressure on him to be the player he was in Euro 2004 always seemed to create an impossible situation for him. You know, it created the ideal that he couldn't live up to fully again because he was so good, so young. That how do you beat that? You know, the normal course of events is people develop and get better and better following that your teenage years. But he was so good at that point that how do you keep improving on that or live up to it when, you know, he had other niggles and injuries and so on in future tournaments? And I think that blinded people to what he was still doing and what he was contributing, because they were comparing him to Wayne Rooney in Euro 2004. Rather than to the rest of the England team at the time and thinking, well, actually, you know, he is contributing more than these other guys. We're just not noticing it. So I think he was a bit unfortunate in that regard, but that's purely because how good he was when he came through Everton, Man United and England at that time. That's incredible. But that's one side of it. I think obviously at Manchester United, he was fully appreciated. You think of some of the people he's been picked ahead of here that we've talked about there, that is some achievement. You know, he went on to win pretty much everything there is possible to win, or perhaps everything that is possible to win at Manchester United. Eclipsed Bobby Charlton's goal scoring record, which he obviously did with the country as well. You think on of things like the impact that Cantona had in the 90s, I was talking about before, helping turn the club into a Premier League winning club, or the impact that Ronaldo has had in terms of the second half of his stint there, not his recent one, obviously, or Van Nistelrooy, the cult status of people like Solskjaer and so on of 99. Dennis Law and so on. You know, a whole load of other people, of course. And for Rooney to be the pick, that says an awful lot about how well-regarded he was and his talents are. The length of service, which I think, as Josh alluded to, is part of the factor that's elevated him above others in his mind. That's something we've talked about on various episodes of this, Gary, and I think it's such a vital thing when comparing players who are of similar stature or levels in your mind, that there's got to be something else that elevates certain people above. Sometimes it's a sort of bond or kinship with the fans that comes out through mannerisms and style and approach. Other times, longevity is the key. It's kind of a loyalty, isn't it? And that's where that bond can develop, and that sort of that feeling about a player can gain and elevate you. Sometimes against people who can be even better. You know, people had more obvious eye catching approaches skills than Rooney that have been on this list. He was eye-catching in terms of his sheer unstoppable nature and force of nature at times. Highly skilled as well, but you know, not as skilled as somebody like Ronaldo. But to elevate above him in terms of in Josh's mind, and I'm sure in countless others, the longevity and the sheer relentless, continuous nature of it all comes into that. I think his length of service is probably only comparable to those from the club of 92, who spent, you know, most of them anyway, their entire careers there, which was just unbeatable, naturally. So I think for him to be pretty close to that level in terms of longevity is key to why he's sort of embedded in Josh's mind and in others, as well as obviously his remarkable feats, scoring feats and general unstoppable nature. I mean, he truly, at his best, he was just simply unstoppable.
Yeah. It's very interesting, just thinking back to what Josh said about all the success he had, and yet, could he have been better? And I just sort of pondering when you said that, I wonder if he'd been playing in a European country, if he'd been playing in Spain or Italy, where the sudden blunder of the Premiership would be less demanding on the physical, on the physique of the young guy, you know, the wear and tear that's demanded in the English game. I just wonder if he would have achieved more in a different type of football. And it's just interesting thing to consider. But regardless, it's a worthy choice. So Wayne Rooney is going as the final selection for the Mount Rushmore monument above the Stretford End at Old Trafford. So we've got Pitch Michael, you have Stam, Paul Scholes, Wayne Rooney. Before I ask Josh to pick his Mr. Manchester United, I just want to, just as I mentioned earlier, it's just a matter of interest. Who was your father's pick, sir, Josh?
So he had Schmeichel in goal, which is the same as me. He had real trouble picking centre back. So he went for one of his childhood heroes, Martin Buchan, the Scottish centre back. In midfield, he then went George Best, obviously. That's his favourite player of all time. And then up front, he had Cantona.
Good calls.
Pretty unbeatable team,
So just to sort of close it out then, Josh, you can either pick one of your own four players, but one of your father's or somebody totally different. So who would you select as being Mr. Manchester United?
Do they have to be a player?
Aiden. Tommy Lyne, mate. Can it be? I think it has to be a player. You're going to pick Ferguson otherwise, and I don't want that. So yeah.
I'm going to pick Fergie.
I think so.
If I was going to pick a player that's Mr. Manchester United to represent Manchester United, then I would probably go with the man that I'm most associated with Manchester United. Oh, it's really difficult because on a personal level, it's Ronnie Johnson because he's my favourite ever footballer. And I supported Man United because I was forced to, basically. But he was the reason I went to Manchester United games. And I'd just like to point out, in all the years I went to Manchester United games, I never once saw him play because he's always injured. Always, always injured. And Ronnie Johnson has messaged me on Instagram before, and I am trying to work up the courage to tell him that I went all over the West Midlands, all the way to Manchester United to watch him. He's always injured. I never saw him. They ruined my childhood in one way. But if I was to choose someone to represent the club as a whole throughout its entire history, then I would probably go for Eric Cantona. Bobby Charlton would be a close second just because of how synonymous he was with the club. But Cantona, as I think both of you mentioned earlier, was the catalyst under Ferguson that took us from being a club that was always, not always, but for a long time, the nearly men, or we won an FA Cup here and there, or we got the Cup Winners' Cup. But we were always longing for that league title, and Cantona was that catalyst that elevated us from being the nearly men into being like the most dominant team for almost 30 years. So yeah, I would go Cantona as being Mr. Manchester United.
That works for me, mate. The nearly men. Aiden, that sounds like a good title for a book, mate, doesn't it?
I know. Someone should write that one. Yes, sounds good.
But yeah. You reckon Cantona as Mr. Manchester United?
I think Josh has put an excellent argument, and that echoes some of the thoughts I was mentioning earlier about him and how pivotal he was. That does good. You know, to take a leaf out of your book, Gary, I could reel off a few other names who would be close in consideration and picking several answers to a question when you're only needing one. Roy Keane, I guess, would be another one who synonymizes the club in terms of style and attitude. And I guess Ryan Giggs for his longevity, but I think there's other factors to discount him now. And Peter Schmeichel as well would be one to note out. But Eric Cantona, yeah, absolutely. Being so pivotal to actually turning the club into what it has become. Maybe not currently now. They could probably do with someone like him back to rescue them again before they start to plummet down. He sort of grabbed them and pushed them through the final barrier that they'd been unable to break through for so long. He was the final bit that caused that, and then he helped them become established at that level as well. You know, many clubs have got themselves to the pinnacle and then quickly fallen away, like the club he left to join Manchester United. But, you know, he helped establish them there. I think the relationship he had with Ferguson was really, really strong, which for a character as fiery as, well, both of them, I guess, is quite something. Even the issues he must have given Ferguson, the headaches, obviously from one hugely famous incident, but overall, the contribution he was able to give and his loyalty to the club up until the point he'd had enough of the whole football world rather than just Manchester United. Absolutely. Mr. Manchester United, obviously with his collar turned up, his arms raised and spinning around, looking at the crowd, adoring him.
Sounds good to me, mate. Sounds good to me. When Josh sort of mentioned Manchester United, I always thought, you know, there's going to be some to talk about. And normally these sort of podcasts last for an hour and 10 or so. And we're approaching 90 minutes now. So before we go into injury time, we'll sort of close down. So that was Josh's Manchester United Mount Rushmore selection. Did you have fun, Josh? Was it good?
Yes, that was really, really enjoyable. And anyone that allows me to talk about Ronnie Johnson is good in my book. Thank you so much for having me on. It was really fun.
Good stuff. Enjoyed, Aiden?
Yeah, absolutely. I should point out that I too failed to see Ronnie Johnson play in his whole three or four games for Newcastle United. I missed all of them.
In fairness, just to round that out, I never saw him play for Chelsea either, so there we go. So we were, sorry, Ronnie, nothing personal, buddy. Anyway, so that was Mount Rushmore Manchester United with guest Josh Butler. So catch us next time, guys, and we'll have some more banter about football and people's selections. Cheers.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.